there's something there that you can amend as needed from year to year, month to month. Well, it's not month to month, basically year to year as conditions external, internal change. One of the goals within the 10-year plan is what Dan spoke about. The need to have a parallel path or track to say that while we are working to pass this constitutional amendment, we need to think about, conceive of, start organizing for, planning for, envisioning what the world is going to look like, if you will, the day after. And part of that involves coming up with, George Bush, you said, you need the vision thing? Doing the vision thing of what are the arenas out there concerning healthcare, education, environment. You fill in the blank concerning those issue areas that you find so important that you may be working on, in addition to Move to Amend. I hope everybody's working on Move to Amend and that this is your number two issue, and your number one issue is whatever it is most passionate to you. But why we think it's important to do this is for a couple of reasons. One, for the reasons that Ken's outlined, that if we just sort of wait, there's this hiatus that goes on. Okay, we wake up 7 years from now, not 10 years, 7 years, and there is all of a sudden an environment where no longer we have no constitutional rights for corporations, and at least inalienable constitutional rights, and money is no longer speech, but what's there? Where are we left? You just can't start then to think about, oh, now what do we do? You got to start beforehand. And how early is the question, strategically? Does it start today, tomorrow, a year? I mean, we can sort of have, I think, a decent discussion about that. Why that's important is not simply sort of because you don't want this vacuum, that like any vacuum, if we don't fill it, somebody else will. Right? And the corporate crowd will figure out some kind of way to subvert it or how to fill that in. But also, to start early, before it happens, is sort of, I think, creating a different culture. It's sort of giving a sense of what we believe is, this is inevitable. This isn't something that, oh my gosh, you know, why should we even think about it? Because who knows what's going to happen? In a sense, that's sort of creating our own self-fulfilling prophecy. We want a self-fulfilling prophecy that says, this is going to happen. It's only a question of when, so we better now start thinking about the day after. And by doing so, it not only projects a sense of confidence, I think, but also provides an arena where we can invite in those organizations that we want to be allied with, that we believe are natural allies, who themselves are struggling to get beyond first base because right now the current defining rules are so stacked against them. So it provides an excuse, an organizing, an educational handle to bring people in, to start engaging with them, to build up relationships, trust, to start recognizing that our campaigns, our interchangeable, if you will, certainly integrated, and that by helping us, we are helping you get there that much further, and that you legitimize by starting to help identify what should be the rules for your issue area, as well as sort of the basic constitutional rules. What should the role of corporations be in society? You know, if you actually read this, this does not give precise numbers about how much money candidates are going to have the day after this. It doesn't say that. You know, all it says is no longer are these constitutional rights of money in corporations shielded by judiciary in the judicial arena. It's no longer protected. It now gets moved back into the legislative arena where we can go at it, where our elected officials at the federal, state, maybe even local, can decide what should be the type of money, if money at all, maybe it should be all publicly funded elections. What should the appropriate role of corporations be in society post our version of the 28th Amendment? That discussion can happen with our allies. So I think there are a lot of good reasons why this is appropriate to begin, and we can kind of cuss and discuss when that should be, what that timetable should be. But the idea of starting now, I think, is so wrong on so many levels. So we can start that cussing and discussing right now.
Yes, thank you. And I just wanted to see if we're thinking about the same thing. So one, I mean, there would have to be something like public campaign finance and all the things we normally think of. But also, wouldn't there have to be in every one of the 50 states new laws about corporate rights and responsibilities? And wouldn't they be different for nonprofit corporations and for-profit corporations? And there might be subclasses of that. So in other words, and the Congress would have to lay out corporate rights and responsibilities, nonprofit and for-profit. So you wouldn't have the same rules for the Girl Scouts that you would have for Exxon in terms of rights and responsibilities, right?
Maybe Boy Scouts, but not Girl Scouts.
Something that sort of worries me is that there could be a negative effect on economic output. In other words, corporations could get scared. They could say, let's incorporate in some other country. Let's do our economic. I mean, it seems to me we have to have a major, major transition plan. And maybe even the amendment would provide for some phase-in period or something. Have you all given any thought to this? And are we thinking about the same kinds of things?
Well, as I'm hearing you explain the concern, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. Well, you're absolutely right that there would need to be some grappling and serious attention at not just the federal level of what now post-amendment would constitute statutory corporate rights.
Statutory,
because we're saying, you know, there should be certain, although at one time, if you know the whole story, they did not have quote-unquote rights, they had mere privileges that were bestowed upon them by the democratically elected state legislatures that looked at the corporate charter, not as a perfunctory tool, but as a democratic tool. And that we're going to be doing the defining, we're flexing our democratic muscles and the like. And so, you know, early on, if we're thinking about what should the new rules or conditions be, you know, you could go back and look at some of those early state constitutions and the like that early on may have had in their corporate, you know, every state has some sort of corporate code that's been eviscerated. But, gee, a generation ago, you know, I'm from Ohio, and Ohio was pretty darn strong in having some anti-monopoly laws that were, that Sherman, senator from Ohio, was terrified about, went to the federal level and said, gee, we need to pass a Sherman Antitrust Act that we still think is so wonderful today. It's about the best antitrust thing we got, but was a completely watered down version of what was passed at the state level. So thinking about what those early state laws would be, at least starting point, may not be a bad starting point because they were pretty darn strongly Democrat.
Let me pick up another aspect of that, and I've been asked that a lot of times, you know. So now the state has all their, they all have their own election laws. So you know, then, you know, how does this work? The thing that makes sense to me is that with the campaign website, okay, if that's provided by the Fed, and if we finance it at least in part, we'd say, well, all these big corporations have been financing elections all along, so we'll just tax a certain percent of their profits to pay for the public funding that they would have spent through big PACs. But here's the catch. If we create a federal PAC that has that, has other benefits built into it, then there could be at least some contingencies in order for the states to participate in those benefits. They would have to agree to a certain set of limitations.
Other queries? Yeah, sir. Hey, could you say who you are and where you're from?
Might as well.
Okay,
I'm
Ron Barlow. I'm in Twin Cities.
Okay.
I'm a member of the Minnesota Citizens Complete Election. Anyway, I work for a company that decided to go offshore because they didn't like paying these taxes. Now, if we go ahead and put this through, what's to keep these companies from going offshore and doing whatever they want anyway? Do we have any control over people who are companies that are incorporated in other countries? Can we?
Yeah.
As opposed, somehow are they beyond our reach?
Yeah. As opposed to today where corporations go offshore and do whatever they want anyway.
Yeah.
Basically, it's kind of how it is.
There's a federal statute that prevents foreign chartered corporations from spending money to influence U.S. elections. The problem is, foreign-owned company charters in the U.S., there's no limits.
Yeah, okay. And they form a phony group and all. Yeah. You know, I should just say, again, a little self-promotion for Move to Amend. There is a couple of committees within Move to Amend. There are standing committees, one of which is called Law and Research. And the Law and Research Committee right now is one of the projects is trying to develop sort of a template, what might be defined as a democratic state corporate code that would, in part, be conceived of by looking at some of the original sort of state constitutions that were deemed, relatively speaking, more populist, progressive, democratic, self-governance, you know, whatever you want to say, to look at as at least beginning points to do this sort of kind of conceiving, to start the ball rolling, to get people involved. I mean, we have some legal background, but also people who are field at the state level or whatever they're concerned about, that they've been hammered.
This is such an important point.
Yeah.
Networking is what, you know, we have got to unite. And this, at least I believe, we have moved to amend, believe that this is the essential core issue. And that there is almost no other issue that isn't in a direct relationship to the corrupting influence of big money. But here's the thing, if we really start networking, I don't have the answer to your question. I don't know whether Greg does or not. So what do? We say, who do you know that's dealing with that problem? That's what we need to do. We need to get the experts, the ones that have the legal background, the economic backgrounds, and so on and so forth, who are not part of that camp that I'll do it for a $100,000 contract. They'll do it like we're doing it because it's the right thing to do. So in each and every one of those places, we don't have to have all the questions, all the answers to all the questions, and we shouldn't try.
Yeah. Other queries? Yeah.
My name's Michael. I'm from Monterey, California.
And are you connected to?
Well, I could move on my badge, but just because I started a petition to abolish the Electoral College, which got 500,000 signatures the week after the election.
That was smart.
I got right to 600,000 people. I have their emails. So just raising a couple questions, and you know, I get a little confused. Like, I'm thinking more maybe like public financing, but it seems to me it's going to change the nature of lobbying. You know, big time. What do lobbyists do if they can't promise money as part of a campaign? And so, I mean, maybe they can promise votes, but then the environmental movement. Anyway, so just thinking about how it might change the nature of lobbying. And then the other thought is, well, what would a public campaign cost? What would it cost if we eliminate all this money? And are we just going to say, well, everybody can give $27, and that's how it, but what about the idea, you know, one of the huge costs is public, is the media, is going, you know, the commercials and stuff. And the fact that these corporations own, essentially own the public airwaves, they've usurped the public airwaves, so wouldn't there be a possibility of making the media corporations donate a certain amount of time for qualified candidates so that you wouldn't need to spend $1 billion on a presidential campaign, because most of that, a huge amount of that money is going to the media.
I believe that that was part of the fair and equal regulations of the FEC. I'm not absolutely sure.
I agree.
I don't have all the information on that.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I think that, you know, the way I see it, we ought to eliminate all of that stuff. No paid campaign ads at all. Then the town hall meetings, the debates, the personal, you know, on each one of those, my page when I'm running for garbage collector in Cincinnati has all of those tools. So I have my picture, I have my history, I have my goals, my plans, all that stuff. I can do a blog where you can ask me questions. I can give you my campaign speech. We can do a candidate debate on that site. Now, that kind of leaves the media out of the picture. But the FEC can regulate, and I don't know whether it's been weakened for sure. But fair and equal is absolutely, if it's not still active, it can be reactivated and the rules set up so that the media is not enjoying the huge influx of unlimited money to say whatever the damn sponsors of that want. You know, they put more money into the election process this last cycle than either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party.
We really need to think. What do you think?
And you are, first of all?
Oh, Karen Galloway.
From?
I think we might be related. But, you know, I think we have to think of it is, how do we start, not only just regulate, I mean, I agree with everything you said, but we need to think of it in terms of what the kind of things do we need to do to reduce the expense. And I personally think one big way would be, if you're making a list for new election reforms, would be set campaign time limits. I do not need to see a senator campaigning for an office for 2 years.
Yeah.
Is that all?
You're right. I'm trying to be conservative, which that doesn't work very well. But anyway, so I mean, I think that's one of the things we put on it. Is, and certainly in other countries, they can only campaign so long for certain roles.
I want to riff off that a little bit. If that could be added to the amendment, right? I mean, could that be language that would go into the amendment? Because, like, really, I mean, it is insane. And if you look what every other country does, it's, you know, a matter of weeks to a month. Yeah.
Talked about that this morning, didn't we?
Yeah.
I just completely reconsidered, you know, what I suggested as just a few, and there are a ton of other things that we could throw into that list of, you know, what definition of bribery and all these kinds of things. In the morning session, they said, you know, all these other countries, they have constitutions that run tens of thousands of pages or some number, you know, so we could take core issues like that and incorporate them into the amendment itself, and then it would, you know, the thing about an amendment, it's hard to get, but it's hard to change.
I'm going to go here and here.
I'm Dan Ryan from Sacramento, California, and, you know, I may be dreaming, but I'd love to see the media corporations broken up. So, I'm old enough to remember when antitrust really meant something, and what happened to antitrust?
You're right.
Well, I mean, after Reagan, they just stopped enforcing it. Is it that they're not enforcing it, or have they weakened it?
my understanding is a couple different levels. Those two, and they've been able to redefine what competition is. It used to be the players of the arena used to be within a certain market, and that market just kept expanding and expanding to where you thought it couldn't go beyond the nation state, the United States. So, all right, there's four media companies that control, you know, 80% of the outlets in the U.S. Yeah, well, that's only, you know, four companies, four out of whatever, but it's not just the four, it's four, those aren't necessarily the biggest in the U.S., they're pint size compared to some European or Asian. So that's how they've been able to get around it, particularly in like banking issues, right? The U.S. banks that we think are just behemoths are actually globally not very large, measured in a couple different ways, but they're politically potent. But that's how they get around it. We're now in a global market. So when you think about it in that frame of expanding the entire frame, well, we're just average size. So it's okay to gobble up this guy and that guy.
While we're on the topic of media, let me put in a plug for Free Speech TV, and particularly Tom Hartman, and of course Democracy Now. I don't listen to corporate media anymore. When I'm doing mindless tests, I listen to Free Speech TV or Amy Goodman.
Just a word on the media. Remember, it's, I think most of what the media uses by way of public airwaves isn't owned, but still leased.
Yeah, and they give them.
And so there's certain, yeah, they pay a certain amount, and then they have borrowed or leased. They still don't own it. And that is still the commons.
Yeah.
And we own that.
That's right.
That's part of the decolonization.
Right.
Have to remember that we still ultimately own the airwaves, and we can set conditions and terms on it if we choose, in that and many other instances,
right,
to flex our democratic muscles.
Right.
Because if you don't flex it, any muscle, what happens to a muscle?
Right.
It atrophies. And that, we've been doing a lot of atrophying for a long time.
I agree with that comment totally. The problem is that they've been practically giving those leases away.
For a long period of time.
For longer periods of time.
It was all part of a plan that began before Reagan. I think most of it began at the University of Chicago in the economics department. And having the Robert Barons having been unseated with the Great Depression and the New Deal, they were kicked way into the background, but they did not go away. And so they had their think tanks and so forth deciding how we're going to get this through, how we're going to change things back. I wish I had 20 minutes to talk about Starving the Beast. If you don't know about Starving the Beast, either take one of my cards and ask me to send it, or Google it, because it was a very specific plan in order to reduce taxes and reduce regulations to put money in their pocket. It was, you can find their original text. They wrote it down, and it's kind of hard to find, but it's there.
Isn't that the Tea Party too?
That goes way before the Tea Party, but yeah. Very much so. You see, the more we gave back,
the government.
The more we gave back from the federal treasury to the very, very wealthy, then they were able to invest it in buying college professorships. Mm-hmm. And the only textbook printer in the United States. So they have been. They outplayed the progressives by a huge amount. They were very clever, and they operated behind the scenes. And as we see more and more, those of us who are aware, what they say in public is just about, I like to think of it as sociopathic, and one of the measures of sociopathology is that what they blame on you is a description of what they're doing. I mean, it's just, in so many cases, it's an easy read. It's an easy read. When Trump says, Hillary's corrupt,
or they're stealing the election, right?
Yeah.
You know, those illegal voters, those 3 to 5 million illegal voters.
Well, back to the topic.
Yeah.
you will notice that Sunday, there is this session in the afternoon. It's called the People's Movement Assembly. And part of what that is a little bit of what this session is talking about. And that is going to address trying to gather people who have attended this entire convention, coming from all of these different conferences or tracks, depending on how you want to look at it, who have been focused on their particular vertical issue area, to come together and try to horizontally see where there's connections, not just in hand-wringing, you know, not just in ain't it awful-ism, meaning, boy, don't we spend a lot of time focusing on what is wrong and what needs to change, and usually focus 95% of the time that we're in front of people talking about that, and leave virtually no time left to conceive of, to visualize what can be better, and how we can be a part of creating our own reality that, you know, yeah, people are opposing, but part of it is our own sense of not knowing where we want to go. So this is an exercise that's kind of designed to collectively figure out where we want to go in a meaningful way, in an authentically participatory way. And this workshop, you know, you had, Dick had one of these slides early on about looking at this issue from 40,000 feet. That's sort of the amendment. But then more on the ground is, you know, how do we make it real with where we are and involving people? And that's what this two-track thing is, of trying to get people now to start visioning where they want to go within the context of the, you know, mutual amendment. The PMA is about trying to envision a whole friggin' new constitution that goes well beyond the mutual amendment, but tries to look at issues of democracy in a meta context of how we can convert the constitution from a property rights document to a human rights document.
One of the things that I really wanted to put in today, actually a couple. Number one, in this divisive world that we live in, it's so full of negativity, it's so much of about what we're against. And I have to say that that's not unimportant to, you know, try to not let Trump run roughshod over us, you know, totally. But as much as possible, and it's more than most people know, we want to start, as Greg is saying, conceptualizing not what's wrong, but what's right. It's a matter of mental health, both for us as individuals and for our society. We're doing this because it's the right thing to do. We need to start reclaiming the high moral ground. Mm-hmm. We need to be, you know, one of the problems, especially with a lot of the gray heads, some of us are still stuck in an anti-religion point of view, and that's bad. That's bad. There are times when it needs to be critiqued, but what we need to do is find a way to dialogue with that so that they're not co-opting the whole notion of they stand for family values. They do, and stuff like that. So I think that's really important. I heard somebody say that just the other day, and it just really struck me. We need to get our feet in that arena too.
So other questions or
I just
queries?
Want to put another shameless plug in. When you're talking about conceptualizing what is right and what is working, Yes Magazine, if people are familiar with Yes Magazine from the Positive Futures Network in Washington State, that's what they focus on.
Fabulous. It's all about what is out there already going on. Mm-hmm. Usually
gives
sort of the local level.
Every quarter when I get it.
I know.
Hi, I'm Sue Peters. I'm a member of the American Monetary Institute. We're one of the sponsors. And we try to educate people about the our money system, which should be our commons, right? But has been given to the commercial banks. They control it. They create it. And it relates back, I wanted to say, it relates back to the media and all the money in the media. if you take the four or six largest media companies and you go and you look at their balance sheet, they are so indebted to the private commercial banks of Wall Street that I'm going to tell you a little story. A friend of mine used to work for a multinational bank, and her boss would make loans to media companies. That's all he did. She worked for him for 10 years. A loan would never be less than $1 billion. And she said to me, well, he would decide to give those loans based on what was the income stream that that media company had. And she said, the bulk of that media stream was the elections, the money that came in on elections.
Yeah, that's the bulk. And they get so much of their money because they do jack up the rates, too. Yeah.
Well, I mean, if the candidates collectively spent $1 billion, wasn't the two of them together, or whatever the number is, someone got that money, right? If they spent that much money, someone received that money. And I think the lion's share is the media.
Right, but they owe the banks. So they're giving that money to the banks with interest.
Yes.
Did that change at all? Are they as dependent on the commercial banks ever since the policy of low interest rate and the creation of money?
Well, she worked for this multinational bank from 1993 to 2003.
Yeah, but with the low interest rates, you know, the companies were borrowing money to pay
probably
off.
Borrowing more money with low interest rates.
Yeah, low interest rates. But I just wonder if they're less dependent because they may have been paying higher interest rates to the banks.
I don't think it's the interest rates. I think that they need those loans rolled over by the private banks because they can't exist without that debt.
Other queries?
Yeah, questions? We've got just a couple of people in here who haven't spoken yet. Can we give you a special opportunity? Not pressure, but if you haven't spoken yet, do you want to add something to our conversation?
I'm curious about the map. If I count that right, 22 states have either passed their state resolution or approved some letter that they have gone on to call on Congress to vote on the amendment. Is there a difference? Is there something we should be working on to have the states pass a resolution, or is the approved letter good enough? Or because as I understand it, there are only four states that have passed the resolution, and you know the other 18 have sent this letter to Congress.
Yeah. I'll pass the answer to Greg, but I will say that this slide and the one with the 80% opposed to Citizens United, those are both, I lifted them off of Move to Amend, and I'm thankful that they put that information out there. It's important stuff. What I get from this is there's a lot more happening than most people probably realize.
Well, what this map is showing are states that have taken some kind of action in calling for a constitutional amendment. They don't all say the same thing in every case, but there is at least some consciousness out there around, at the very least, dealing with money in elections. So some of those deal exclusively with just money in elections. Others address issues of money in elections and corporate constitutional rights. And then some are sort of in between and all. So there's a variety of things. There's no single approach as of yet that's crystallized. As well as a lot of those dots indicate municipalities. Mm-hmm. So it's not just states,
you got
municipalities.
That, but I was more interested in the states.
But in terms of whether they have any umph or not, some do. Four of them.
Four states.
You wanted to comment on that.
I think there's sort of two dimensions of this. One is, what do they say?
Right.
And there's some variation there. Like Montana had a pretty strong one. And Colorado had a weaker one. that there's four kinds of actions that states have taken. Maryland so far has only done a letter that was signed by legislators. That's pretty weak. Then there's the please Congress do something that is passed by both houses of a state legislature. That's pretty weak too.
That's called a resolution.
Yeah, that's a resolution. Then there's a ballot question where all the voters in the state who show up at a certain election are asked to vote on it. That to me seems to have a little more oomph. And most of those you needed lots and lots of signatures, tens or hundreds of thousands of signatures to get that on the ballot. And then there's the...
But that's also calling for please do something.
Yeah, that's still a please do something. And then there's the convention under Article 5 of 34 states applied to Congress for a convention on a certain topic. Then the Constitution says that the Congress must call the convention. So that's never happened that there's been a convention call. But in the case of, say, the 17th Amendment for the direct election of senators, they got within one or two states, and then the Congress passed the amendment. So far, five states have issued an application to Congress, and another six or seven states have passed it through one house but not the other. And there's a group called Wolfpack that's nationally that's working on that.
And in fact, in 20 minutes, there is a session coming up that looks at this whole comparison and contrast between the amendment approaches. That's, I think, room 250. Which room is this?
We're in it.
Oh, okay. Maybe it's not.
And Sunday at 9:30, we have a workshop just on the convention.
Those five states are Vermont, California,
Illinois, Rhode Island, and
in the back.
I came in late. My name is Stephen Wolfe. We're talking about media and corporations being dominant. And the Federal Reserve, as you know, is owned by the banking system. And that Federal Reserve uses our money that it creates literally to educate the populace and control the media through grants and contracts to universities in terms of all the states have economics councils that receive money. And so I'm a sixth grade teacher. I'm teaching my kids the stock market game, which fits in to my kids who've learned how to have a sense of fairness in the playground growing up as little kids. Now I'm teaching them how to be greedy and buy stocks on margin, how to borrow more money, go in debt, and preparing them to be a part of this corporate empire where you've got to work and gain money. And so it's learning to put a stop to that. But I'm just to share with you that the Federal Reserve controls the whole conversation. And they do it to a tune, I believe, of several hundred million dollars a year. The New York Times did an article on it a few Decembers ago. But it's a situation we need to turn around.
So that is one of many issue areas that preemptively we should start kind of grappling with. And I mean, I know in the case of the real monetary reform, AMI group, there already is a vision thing out there that's been codified into a law, not just conceptually, but previously introduced, which would represent one piece of the what we would like to see as we move toward, inevitably, this constitutional amendment that would open the door to lots of room for groups to promote concepts, ideas, actual plans that would promote justice, peace, sustainability, nonviolence. So that's why we think this is important not to wait for inevitably the amendment to pass, because I think it is inevitable one way or the other. I mean, either two things. Either something like this passes or we go complete fascism. One or the other. It is going to, you know, one or the other. So I just think it's inevitable. This is the American people will not allow this to happen.
Last thought for me, maybe. Don't, please don't ever forget that 80% of the American public are already there. that's the reality that we've got to make incarnate, make it flesh and blood. That's where it's at. That's, we've got to keep, we've got to believe it. And the other part of that is, once again, John Stuart Mill, against a great evil, a small effort does not produce a small result. It produces no result at all. And I believe that's an apt description of reality. We've got to think big, and we've got to believe.
Okay, well, thank you. If you want to stick around, I'm moderating the session from 2:30 to 5:45.
What is that?
The 28th Amendment, what should it say, and how will we make it happen? Right here.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to keep Howard as a friend.
Anybody else want to sign a petition?
That's all right. Yeah.